Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 76.PR2817, certificate number 26694, the Astor Place Riot. Hello, David Hyde. Welcome to the show.
Hello, John Roderick.
David is recording here in the bunker. And the only reason that we allowed him in the house is that, first of all, he's local. Second of all, he's a verified public radio producer at a public radio station that I know and am a frequent guest. And third and foremost, I was just a guest on your podcast.
Yes, Blue City Blues with my co-host Sandeep Kaushik.
And tell us about Blue City Blues.
It's a podcast that emerged out of our interest in local politics. And the idea for this one is to take what is currently local, mostly the local section of your newspaper, and look at it from a national perspective. What if we treated all blue cities as a kind of urban archipelago and understood or tried to analyze their problems sort of collectively, whether it's homelessness or addiction or some of the positive problems that cities have, which is what we talked to you about, which was how do you make a cool city or how do you make a cool city cooler? And John was a fun guest, as everybody to this podcast knows.
What do you do if a cool city doesn't feel that cool anymore? Is a tough one.
Yeah,
which is true for a lot of cool cities.
And there is some regrets and nostalgia expressed on that episode because it was three Gen X dudes talking about. The good old days.
What about, I know you're Canadian or originally, what about Calgary and Edmonton?
Everyone in my family is from Edmonton except for me originally. And, or my dad's not, but everybody else in my family was born in Edmonton. My mom actually, her family had the first car in Edmonton, I think in 1915.
Wow.
And her house became a historic home in Edmonton. But she grew up in the 30s. With, you know, it was the sad depression era.
And the first car in Edmonton, that's quite a distinction.
Yeah. Well, it's a treat to be here is all I can say.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to have you. Well, all right. So why don't you walk me through what brought you here and what it is that you want to have entered into the permanent record of the Omnibus Project?
Well, starting with a question for you.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Alamo?
I have not. And there are a lot of national parks I haven't visited,
yeah.
Which is kind of a little bit unusual. I won't say it's shameful because it is what it is. Most of the places I've visited, I didn't really make a point to be there. I just was there and I was like, oh, look at this. I'm right. At the St. Louis Arch. Who knew?
Yes.
And the Alamo, because Austin is close enough to San Antonio. Even though San Antonio is a huge city, we played Austin three times a year, and no one ever booked us a show in San Antonio. And I think culturally, maybe it's not an indie rock town.
It's not so indie rock.
And so it could have been a side quest at any point, but every year on tour, we knew we were going to be playing five shows in Texas, and it just never occurred to me like, hey, book a show in San Antonio. And then one day I realized I've never seen the Alamo. And I know that downtown San Antonio has been made beautiful. There's a river through the town, the Riverwalk. Yeah. Haven't seen any of it.
I should have, I messed up the first, I should have said, have you ever been to the Alamo in New York City?
Have you ever been to the Alamo in New York City?
Yeah, was the question I meant to ask.
Well, but still, that was a very good question. Have you ever been to the Alamo in Texas? The Alamo in New York City? No, I don't think so. Unless it's got a different name now.
Well, so it is the name of a sculpture at Astor Place on the edge of the East Village.
Right.
It's about 15 feet high. It's this giant Corten steel metal thing that you can actually go up to and spin. It's very clever.
I've been to Astor Place.
Does this ring a bell?
I've never spun any kind of statue.
A lot of people looking at it, you wouldn't imagine that you can spin it. You sort of have to know.
Or you have to watch somebody do it and go, yeah, I want
to
do that.
Friend
now.
Has to show you. But
is it like a prayer wheel? Is it like a Buddhist?
No. It's a giant, imposing metal thing in Astor Place. And it was created by this artist, Tony Rosenthal, in 1967. And his wife sees the scale and the mass of the thing and says, that reminds me of the Alamo. And
Now I recognize it. It's a giant.
You've seen it.
It's like a Borg. It's like a
steel cube. It is a Borg.
It's the Borg.
Yes, it is the Borg. It's great.
I didn't know you could spin that.
You can spin it.
The Alamo does not look whimsical at all. It looks terrifying.
That's what his wife was thinking. Clearly.
Right.
She's like, ugh, reminds me of, I don't know, the Alamo. So I bring it up because you've been there though.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You've seen it. I used to walk by it when I lived in New York City because I would meet friends in the East Village for dinner or whatever to go out. And I had this rent stabilized apartment in the West Village.
Oh, lucky.
You couldn't afford to go out there. Yeah. It was $500
a month.
So I would walk to the East Village and then walk by that thing like every, whatever it would be, Friday night or something at 2 a.m.
Right.
You know, hoping that I made it home probably. But anyway, I bring it up because it's just around the corner from the site of one of the most deadly riots in the 19th century, the Astor Place riot. Outside the Astor Place Opera House.
When you think about New York and violence in New York, you think about definitely like the Martin Scorsese movie about...
Oh, yes.
About...
Gangs of New York.
5 points.
Right.
And then you think about the Civil War violence in New York.
The New York City draft riots.
The draft riots.
Yeah.
But then you feel like by the mid-19th century, things have somewhat settled down in New York.
Well, New York City draft riots, 1863.
Right.
And the Astor Place riot, 1849. May 10th. 1849.
Oh, so it predates the Civil War.
It does.
Wow. Okay.
It does.
And yet the Astors were already the prominent New York, banking family?
They were. John Jacob Astor himself, made his money in beaver pelts.
Yeah,
he's sort of the Bill Gates of beaver pelts.
Yeah,
and then goes on to become a kind of real estate mogul.
Okay.
And invests in various properties, including the Astor Place Opera House, which gets built in 1847, a few years before this riot, deadly riot, where at least 22 people are killed, another 150 injured, and it's the deadliest incident with troops firing on civilians dating back to the American Revolution in the entire United States.
Oh, so yeah, even to this day, there hasn't been an instance where the troops have fired on people to the extent that more than 20 people died.
That I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Well, if you think about Kent State, less than 10.
Four dead. And how many dead in Ohio?
Four dead in Ohio.
And then Civil War, though, pretty bad.
Yeah, but civilian rioters.
Doesn't.
Not really.
New York City draft riots. How many people die there?
But was that troops firing into crowds?
Probably not. Well, okay, so we're going to get to all of this, okay. Or some of this at least. Yeah.
Have you watched the television show The Gilded Age?
Oh, yes.
Yes, because Astor Opera House plays a role in...
It does, and the Astors are kind of the snobs who aren't willing to accept the new moneyed New Yorkers into polite society.
Yeah.
It's kind of a wonderful and gross show at the same time.
Yeah, I don't watch episodic television when it comes out.
Yeah.
But my
stream it later.
My daughter's mother slash partner, she will introduce these shows to me and say, "Now we're watching this." And I was like, "Ugh, The Gilded Age. Really? This is just a Downton Abbey for America."
That's fairly accurate.
Yeah, but over time, being forced to sit on the couch and handed a bowl of ice cream and said, "You're watching this show,"
it's pretty entertaining.
I ended up enjoying it a lot.
Yeah, it's good. Although its treatment of important historical events like major railroad strikes and that sort of thing is could be better.
Yeah, a little fudgy,
a little fluffy. So, Astor Place Riot, 1849, May 10th. This event happens because there's a bunch of dudes. You mentioned Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York.
It's also a problem. Dudes, anytime you get dudes.
Those dudes, those kinds of dudes, the Bowery Bohoys, whether they were the Irish gangs or the nativist American gangs, did not like the Astor Place Opera House and did not like the performer who was there that evening, who was a British Shakespearean actor, which leads me to my next question for you.
Yes.
When is the last time you went to see a Shakespeare play?
Well, my daughter in eighth grade played Malvolio. And it was an eighth grade production. And she now is kind of mad that she keeps getting cast. You know, she wants to be the heroine, and she keeps getting cast as these like male characters who are the comedic, answer. So we're watching an eighth grade Twelfth Night, and she's this kind of bumbling male, sort of comedic energy, and I thought, oh, come on, you know, this is just they recognize in you that you're a comedian and this is funny. But then she's now in high school, and in both of the high school plays that where she's played a role, it's a prominent role, and it's always a guy with in a suit with a like a Brooklyn accent and a big cigar, and she's
Whoa.
Like, she's like, "Put me in a dress. I'm a girl. I want to be the girl in the." And I'm like, "I know, but your Brooklyn accent is kind of unimpeachable."
But she's good at it.
She's
my sister was in starred in all the school plays when she was a kid, Princess and the Pea, et cetera, et cetera. And she was great at those comedic roles, and then made the mistake, I always thought, of becoming a musician instead, because she was great at that.
Yeah,
stuff. Like would have been, you know, great. Musical theater actor in some ways, but is also a great musician.
Well, and I always say to her, like, look at the heroine in so many of these productions. She's a vacuous character. This is the problem with so many female characters written by men. What does she do? What does the princess in The Princess Bride do? She is not fun.
Yeah.
Relative to everybody else, with the exception.
Isn't that changing? It has to be changing.
It is. It's changing, but it's still, it's the Bechdel test, right? Do two female characters ever talk to each other not about a male character? Do they ever have an independent conversation that advances the plot that isn't just one of them complaining about the male lead?
Yeah.
But so, in answer to your question, Twelfth Night was the last Shakespeare play that I watched, a truncated version of it. When was the last time I saw a real proper production.
Did you go as a kid? Did your parents take you to see Shakespeare as a kid?
No.
That was not a thing.
No, it was in Anchorage, less so.
Right.
I have a group of friends here who in the early 90s made their way to Seattle from Florida and Virginia in a painted school bus where they stopped in towns along the way and did free, like, one-act Shakespeare in the park.
Shakespeare in the park.
And then
Joseph Papp's Shakespeare in the park, but on a bus.
On
That's
a bus.
Great.
And they were all on mushrooms or whatever, and they would pass the hat and get enough gas money to get back on the bus and make it to the next town.
That's fun.
It was really fun. And when they arrived in Seattle, you know, of course they were, that's a pretty hippie, but erudite hippie.
Yeah.
They got to Seattle and they were like, we're home. It was 1991 or something. This is it.
Yeah.
You know, finally. And they're all still here.
Playing at Green Lake every...
Well, they became adults, but, you know, they were part of the great theater scene here in the 90s, right? We talked about it on Blue City Blues.
Yeah. Well, okay. But when you think about Shakespeare, as you thought about it sort of growing up in school, in high school, I will tell you, in my house, my mom, you learned piano, you went to the symphony, and she took us to see, or took me to see, kind of some of the easier plays. And this was a part of sort of middle class cultural uplift.
Right.
You were building your son or daughter's character by exposing them to these things.
Well, based on a cultural premise that there are only a few books. Right. There's Shakespeare. There's the Bible.
There's the great books.
And there's the great books, which fit on a shelf.
Right. That's right.
And my grandfather was someone who could quote Shakespeare all day. And whether or not he had only memorized the lines that you ever heard him say, or whether he knew the whole corpus, I didn't know him, so I'll never know. But, you know, my dad had all this Shakespeare at one remove from his dad. But I've gone on record as having said I've never read Shakespeare, because my whole adult life I've been saving it in case I ever go to prison. The idea being, if I go to prison, I'll become a...
You'll have something to do.
I'll be a student of Shakespeare, and I'll have all that quiet.
Really? Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Okay, so culturally, though, did it in any way sort of represent that to you growing up? You thought of Shakespeare that way. It was like, were you to read Shakespeare, you would become a better person. More accomplished person, a person people might want to know.
Well, and also
you might represent class mobility and that
better,
sort of thing.
What it makes you is a better reader.
Better reader.
Because then everything you read, then you pick up all the allusions to Shakespeare, all the themes are there. And so as a student in college, it was definitely seen as an advantage and and a class advantage back when class meant something other than having money.
Aspiring bourgeois
class
would, in my family's case, you know, go to the symphony and do those sorts of things because that's what you did if you were trying to elevate your children.
And
instill in them the right character.
It was culture that was one step above you, but you were capable of achieving it.
Yeah.
In a way that you were never going to be somebody that gave $1 million to an art museum.
No.
But you could go to the opera and enjoy it.
You could do it, although the perception kind of was rich people.
Yeah.
Aristocrats are really the ones who are going to the opera. They're going to the symphony. They're going to see Shakespeare in fancy
ballet and
places.
Yeah.
Right? That's the high culture that we thought of growing up.
But what happened in the 70s where Shakespeare in the Park started, you know, Shakespeare in Central Park became a kind of...
Well, I think there was a recognition that if you draw a wall around something and make it inaccessible and kind of repulsive to working people, that ain't good if you're trying to uplift a culture.
Right. Level society.
Yeah, it's kind of not working. And so Joseph Papp was like, why don't we make this fun? I mean, it was fun when Shakespeare wrote these things. Let's make it a cross-class fun thing today.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I think in New York, the people that ended up going to Shakespeare were probably people with college degrees.
Yeah, right. Grant, do you ever wake up sweaty or freezing or just uncomfortable in your bed?
Do I ever? Yeah, all the time.
Is that right? Are you like a, or do you have a rough time sleeping?
I'm actually a pretty good sleeper, but yeah, oh yeah. I mean, especially, it's mostly the sweatiness, just waking up like, ugh, sticky and sweaty.
Well, that's the thing. The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep, Grant.
Yeah, I can see.
And I used to have the same problem, and that's why I switched to Miracle Made Sheets, longtime supporter of the Omnibus program. Ken and I have extolled the virtues of Miracle Made Sheets for now a couple of years, and I'm glad to have you here now so that I can basically like twist your arm and convince you.
Or spread the good word.
Spread the good word. That's right. That's a better way of putting it. One thing you and I, you know, we're both space technology aficionados, science fiction Gen Xers.
Yeah.
Miracle Made Sheets are inspired by NASA technology. They use silver infused temperature regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long.
The future is here.
The future is here. And, you know, you don't think of your sheets as being some kind of like future tech, but way better than trying to genetically alter yourself so that you live to be 200 years old.
Right. Or not, yeah. or not sweat while I sleep.
or not sweat while you sleep. Think about that. You live to be 200 years old, but every night you're tossing and turning. Sweating under your bed sheets. Why is it even worth it?
No thanks.
In addition to temperature regulating, silver infused sheets actually has an antibacterial design as well, and they help you sleep cleaner and clearer.
I'm all in. I'm convinced.
All right. Well, let me then explain to our listeners who and to you how to upgrade your sleep or, and this is key, give the gift of better rest to a friend or loved one. Go to trymiracle.com/omnibus to try Miracle Made Sheets today. You'll save over 40%. And when you use the promo code omnibus, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, Grant, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. So go to trymiracle.com/omnibus, code omnibus, put the code omnibus in at checkout, and get 40% off plus an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. Thanks, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Grant, have you got a kitty cat?
I got two cats.
I knew that about you. I asked you,
yes.
I asked you, but I know your kitty cat story.
That's right.
And are your kitty cats fussy eaters?
No, they're pretty good. They're pretty good eaters, I have to say. Maybe too good, one of them.
Too good. are you somebody that pampers their cats, or are you somebody that just sort of treats them like farm animals?
Oh, I mean, in the great human history of having cats, I probably pamper them more than farm animals.
Yes. Well, let me introduce you to an incredible way to pamper your animal and also kind of to treat them like your little human friends. I'm talking about Smalls. Smalls is fresh human grade cat food that does so much more than just feed your cat. It helps them live full and healthy lives. Most cat food out there, Grant, is made with meat byproducts, cheap fillers, and artificial ingredients. Basically stuff that isn't great for your cat. I try hard not to eat all that stuff, although, I mean, I get by without meat byproducts or cheap fillers. Artificial ingredients are a little harder to avoid, but why would we give our cats those things?
I don't know, man.
Well, you know why? It's because big pet food does it, because it's cheaper to make. But what they save on cost, your cat pays for with their kitty cat health. But Smalls, Grant, Smalls is different. Their fresh recipes are made with at least 80% animal protein, and They're gently cooked because, of course, a cat isn't going to cook in its native environment. They're gently cooked to retain all their nutrients and flavor. They never add fillers or artificial ingredients, and their food is so healthy that 88% of cat parents say that after feeding smalls, their cats have better digestion, a softer and shinier coat, and more energy to play because it's actually good for cats. And also, they include little treats, and my cat goes bananas for those treats, like flipping out. Actually the best. Actually awesome to watch. Your cat's health, Grant, and longevity starts with what they eat, and I'm going to encourage you and all of our listeners to try Smalls. You'll get 60% off your cat's first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you go to smalls.com/omnibus. 60% off your first order, free shipping, free treats that drive your cat absolutely bonkers with joy for life when you head to smalls.com/omnibus.
Cast your mind back a long time ago, let's say, to the American Revolution.
Okay.
Before the Astor Place riot, Shakespeare was a different animal back then, and theater was really, really different.
Culturally.
Yes, it occupied a very different position in society.
What was it? Was it considered like old-fashioned? Was it?
It was sort of considered the opposite of something that would build character and lead to moral uplift.
Really, it was like a base.
If you went to theater, it was all dudes in those days, pretty much, who went to theater, unless you were a sex worker,
right?
And you went to theater to get drunk.
It was
maybe get in a fist fight.
It was
maybe
ribald.
Hire a prostitute and maybe throw things. And then you'd watch a little Shakespeare. But often it would be one act or they'd change the ending. There were all these different treatments. And so instead of it being a tragedy, it might have a happy ending. And crowds like that.
So proto-vaudeville.
Oh, yes. This is a long time before vaudeville.
But that idea that you go to a rowdy house and...
It's punk rock.
Yeah.
The audience is involved and very much engaged in the whole experience. And maybe it would be Hamlet. You'd see one act of Hamlet. If the audience liked a scene or it's Hamlet's soliloquy, they would demand that the performer repeat it again and again and again until they got tired of it. And after that, you might have a camel act, a melodrama, all in one bill.
How is this not more commonly known? When you see films, when you see that era represented, there you very seldom see, well, the working class portrayed. I guess that's true in a lot of art. But when you think about like American Revolution era films, we're always looking at people in powdered wigs. We never see the drunks.
Right. Why isn't it better known? I mean, I think partly because theater history and history are sort of separate things, and the 19th century American theater is a little bit of a backwater in terms of the plays that were written. So there was a while there where nobody was paying any attention to it, I think. And they weren't paying attention to it in English departments or history departments. So it didn't find its way into popular culture, is
my
guess.
But from 1600 to 1800... There's 200 years where those plays that we now think of as the absolute center of the elevated
high culture, yeah.
Those were just like rock shows.
There were different types of theaters, but roughly speaking, yes. And so for that reason in America, There were two ways in which respectable people, ministers and respectable people, viewed theater as something to keep at arm's length. One of those was this longstanding tradition of anti-theatricality dating back to like the ancient Greeks, where they had plays, but Plato didn't like them, right? He kind of thought that it was morally corrosive to go to the theater. And that view persists all the way until in American culture, in 1865, when Lincoln gets assassinated, he's in a theater and there are sermons, not just in the South, but also in the North, saying, well, what does he expect when you hang out in the devil's playground, I mean, what do you think is going to happen in a place like that? So not quite blaming him, but sort of blaming him for the assassination because he was at the theater.
You think about the Nazis, like they said the theater is a way that the Jews are bringing their corruption.
Yes.
And their
yes. This is a widespread view in Western culture for sure. And there's add to that during the revolution, actually, the Continental Congress suggests that all states ban theater during the revolution, which they do, partly because
the 13 colonies banned
theater. Yes. Because it's considered morally corrosive and also maybe too British. And we're going to develop a new kind of American culture. And what's that going to look like? And maybe it shouldn't involve theater.
And are there a lot of plays written during this period that are like specifically to have uplifting themes? And is there a kind of...
Forget the uplift. The uplift's my mom and maybe
right.
your grandpa. But back then, no one's really thinking too much about Shakespeare in terms of uplift.
But they're not writing a nativist kind of Presbyterian theater where
religious theater.
Yeah, where
no.
bad women.
No, get no, no. That's a great question. So the point here is that it's irredeemable.
The whole
it's
idea.
But it's irredeemable for people in the same way that a brothel is irredeemable. People right. are going.
Yeah.
But it's not like you can fix it. Theater is just something to be kept at arm's length.
It's something like the kind of Sharia ban on graven images or even, you know, when you think about in Afghanistan where they're blowing up any kind of representation.
Well, no,
of
because everyone, all men of all classes are going to this, you know, every night. Like
right.
I said, like the brothel, right? It's like, it's unseemly, it's wrong, it shouldn't be happening. There's no fixing it, but people are still going to it.
Right.
Right. So there's sermons about it. It's banned temporarily during the revolution, but it is popular, right? Because you're getting into fistfights and you're drinking and you're yeah. hiring sex workers. It's
right.
got all the things.
And so, are theaters like surreptitious? Are they? Do they appear on the outside just to be warehouses? And
oh no,
sneaking in.
No, but keep in mind. I mean, street walking is visible and open in New York in this period as well, right?
Well, sure.
So. You know,
it wasn't Seattle. Well, it is in Seattle even now.
Well, that's right.
If you've been on Aurora
that's right.
Boulevard at any point.
That's right. So this view persists until the 1840s. And you're familiar with the term kind of moral reform, right? The moral,
sure.
moral reformers.
Sure. I'm a moral reformer even
in your own way.
In this basement.
Yes. Yeah. So there's the temperance reform movement. Right. There's anti-vice crusading. There's abolitionism. There's vegetarianism. There's feminism. There's a lot of isms that develop during this period. And theater reform is kind of a part of that. So Horace Greeley, newspaper editor at the New York Tribune and starts the Republican Party, big abolitionist guy. He's all of those things. He's also a big theater reformer and a champion of the Astor Place Opera House when it's being built, because what these theater reformers say is, hey, wait a minute, theater's this powerful force in society. What if instead of turning our noses up at it or sermonizing against it, we fix it, make it better, get rid of all the unseemly activities. So we'll build this place that good people can go to, wealthier people can go to, in Astor Place, and it's got a dress code, in fact. People wear white kid gloves and vests and fancy dresses. And so that's what they do. And that's what the Astor Place Theater is a part of this effort to reform society and make it better in a way that my mother would have approved of.
So,
right?
Something
this is
completely...
Because Shakespeare now
yeah.
can become something different, a place for moral character development and uplift. So yes, although culturally, in terms of the kind of analogous culture wars, these were kind of our people. These were cosmopolitan urbanists.
Right.
The people who liked the Astor Place riot would have been Herman Melville and Washington Irving and our kinds of folks.
Yeah.
As opposed to just the fire and brimstone people who would have supported that. But this is more a class-based cultural reform movement to try to improve society and make
yeah,
it
right.
better. And look, with the temperance reform movement, for example, I mean, people were drinking too much booze in the 1820s. Like, I don't know, it's like six bottles of pure corn liquor for every man, woman, and child or something like that. It was a lot.
Well, fresh water, harder to come by than it is now.
Well, there is that, but it went well beyond that. And the women and the children weren't drinking as much. So it was, you know, it was destroying families and it had problems and stuff. And historians, and you know this, have looked at the temperance reform movement and said there was that side to it. But it was also about wanting to make sure that your workers showed up to the factory on time on Monday morning.
Right. Well, and we've been living through a time when liberal progressivism has increasingly become gone from being like the cool people to the scolds, the moral scolds.
It's a fine line.
And it has happened before, right? The cool, like, yeah, we should, like, the idea of liberty can really waffle when you feel like we need to increase liberty by restricting, like, these immoral
pursuits. Let's improve society by policing language.
Right.
And we're going to persecute any poorly educated working class person who steps out of line.
Maybe. And that will improve society.
Yeah. What could go wrong?
What could ever go wrong with that plan?
Well, I don't know, but I will say that when it came to this plan in 1849 or 1847, there were some things that ended up going wrong.
Right.
So, now I should tell you about the riot itself. So the Bowery Boys, these dudes, working class dudes, pictured in Gangs of New York.
And when was Gangs of New York set?
It's set, I think, from the 1840s. And I feel like they also depict the New York City draft riots in that film.
They do at the end.
So I think it probably must go from about the 40s to the 60s, but I don't know for sure.
So we are actually talking about Gangs of New York era
dudes.
Dudes. And that's what New York looks like at the time.
Yes. Picture, if you've seen it, if you haven't, you've got to go watch it. It's like 45 hours long.
Yeah, it is.
And some people didn't like it. But
Daniel Day-Lewis does an incredible job.
I think it's a little underrated. I liked it. But anyway, and it's very accurate. Like the violence, the menace. I think some of that, unfortunately, is pretty accurate. But anyways, they have a favorite actor who is not the actor performing that evening. And this guy's name was Edwin Forrest, an American Shakespearean actor who, in many ways, resembles Captain Kirk from Star Trek in terms of his acting style. So think masculine, robust. Captain Kirk's Canadian, but this guy, he embodied American Jacksonian era kind of masculinity.
To be or not to be.
so I was apparently Kirk, William Shatner was a classically trained Shakespearean actor.
I would never have guessed.
But think about it. Doesn't it actually make sense? Because that overperformance is kind of a stagey performance.
Yeah, he does prowl the stage, doesn't he? He like a wild cat.
Like a human as opposed to a Vulcan too. Like, you know, he's.
Oh, right. He's not humanness. Elevated. He's down in the, he can smell the burning of the lights. I see that. I get him now. The oil lamps of the Lower East Side.
But Spock,
what? God damn. Yeah, he's it's too good.
And it seems like overacting. And by the way, all of this stuff back then would seem very much like overacting to us today. But
it's called playing to the back of the room.
Yes.
Right. And it doesn't always translate to television or film.
That. Oh yes. Right. Exactly.
But but when you're standing on a stage and there's no microphones, you know, you got to get it out.
You got to project.
Yeah.
So Forrest develops his career starting in sort of the 1820s, kind of leading up to this, playing not just Shakespeare, but other kinds of roles. And, as I said, sort of embodies what people think of as an American man. And he's very closely affiliated actually with the Democratic Party and Andrew Jackson's movement in a lot of ways. So
a populist.
He is closely linked, and his fans would all be Democrats who, you know, so in terms of the political breakdowns, they would have, it's a bit of an aside from our story, but just
this is at a time when Democrats were different than they are now.
They were anti-temperance, anti-abolition,
right?
you know, anti-vegetarian, et cetera.
A belief that the vote should be really like
pro Trail of Tears.
Yeah,
let's see what else.
Pro farmer, pro rancher.
That true. Yeah. That too. Yeah. That piece of the populist aspect of it. Right. Yeah. Pro working man.
Right.
So Forrest is, but he appeals to all classes of theater goers. They like him. And in fact, he goes to England in the 1830s for a tour, and he's well received. He's kind of this quaint American actor. They see what he's going for, and they dig it.
Yeah.
But he comes back in the 1840s, and the mood has sort of soured. Dickens is kind of turned a little anti. It's the era of the ugly American at this point. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. From their perspective, he comes over, and the critics pan his tour. And remember, this is the guy who our Bowery boys are identifying with, and so they're reading all about this. And he's so pissed off, and he assumes that the reason his tour is failing is because his rival, a fellow Shakespearean actor by the name of William Charles Macready, who happens to be performing at the Astor Place Opera House the night of the riot, is behind it.
Oh, it's a conspiracy.
Yes. There's no evidence to prove this, but he believes that Macready has put the critics up to this. And so these two are rivals, and Forrest decides to get some revenge by going to a Hamlet performance that Macready has put on and performs himself as an audience member, a very public hiss, and says afterwards to the press, why did you do that? He says, well, Macready introduced a fancy dance that was a desecration of the scene.
So he's calling him effeminate. He's saying
We know what a fancy dance means.
Yes, we do.
That's right. And Macready's style is, in fact, much more cerebral. He is Patrick Stewart's, version of Jean-Luc Picard, or almost more like he would embody sort of a Timothée Chalamet-type physical presence to Forrest's Captain Kirk, right? They're two very different types of actors, Shakespearean actors.
We recently had an omnibus on that was, you know, kind of John Quincy Adams era discussion of the political climate at the time.
Yes.
And it was very much, you know, his administration and his era, it was very much a kind of rural versus urban. And the urbanists were very contemptuous and very sort of like, well, the vast majority is never going to understand it. And so we don't need to take into consideration the mob, the mass, because we're the ones that are going to guide our nation.
And, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so, and that is the exact kind of cultural tension we see emerging here leading up to this bloody riot. Exactly right.
Grant, how do you feel about your hair?
Being middle-aged, I feel okay about it, but you know, it could be better, I'm sure.
Is it starting to recede?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Starting to see more forehead there.
More forehead. I saw some old pictures of myself the other day, and I thought, man, my forehead's a lot bigger than it used to be.
What about what about up on the top? Are you starting to? Yeah, it's the place you can't see, but every once in a while you catch a photo of yourself, and you're like, oh no.
Not yet, but I'm sure Father Time is coming for it.
I was reading an article about the hair transplant mega industry that's in Turkey now.
Ooh.
Billions of dollars they're making in Turkey by giving people from around the world this like totally crazy, you know, robot-driven hair transplant. But I have an easier solution. I have a better solution, a more natural solution for our listeners. You're still a young guy, Manager Grant. But
relatively,
when you get to be my age, which, you know, a lot of our listeners are like rolling their eyes. They're like, you're still a young man. Why? I'm 95. Those are listeners that started listening to the program when Ken was the co-host. But I have a marvelous solution for hair loss, and that is the company Hims. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work. including choose oral medication, serums, and sprays, whichever you feel like is the delivery method that works best for you and your busy lifestyle. These are doctor-trusted ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can stop further hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. I've seen this. If my own personal experience, my own eyes have witnessed hair regrowth. I think if you watch Ken on the Jeopardy program, you're going to be experiencing what I would describe as hair regrowth, Grant.
All right.
Because you think of Ken as a guy with like a lustrous head of hair. But I'll tell you, during the pandemic, man, the glare alone made it hard to do the show. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. I know this from past experience. I have gone way out of the way to help myself feel like myself. But Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Find the right hair regrowth treatment for you with flexible subscription options, access to 24/7 provider support, and once-a-day treatment options that fit your daily routine. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/omnibus. That's hims.com/omnibus for a free online visit. hims.com/omnibus. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Go to hims.com/omnibus.
But there's this kind of ostensible spark for the riot, which is the rivalry between these two actors.
Right.
So, Forrest says, well, this guy has no taste. And, McCready, the English actor, says, well, Forrest has no taste, and Forrest goes home back to the United States. Then in 1849, our English actor, the more Timothy Chalamet / Patrick Stewart version of Shakespearean actors, the most famous Shakespearean actor in England at the time. So he's a real, I don't know how much detail you want to know about him, but he's really like considered a great actor, especially in England. And also people like these New York intellectuals appreciated his performances as well.
Right, right.
He's uplifting theater. He's making it better.
This is post War of 1812, where the sentiment in the United States is now becoming more and more pro English. They are on the part of
elites.
The elites,
but right. Not on the part of especially the Irish Bowery boys or even the nativist dudes. They do not like this guy.
Right.
And everything he stands for.
Right, because it's aristocratic.
It's aristocratic, and this theater reform movement is coming for them and their way of life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, they've got a thing going.
Yeah.
And it's been that way forever. And who are these middle-class reformers to tell them how to live their lives? And so what ends up happening is MacCready comes to the U.S. for a tour in 1849, and Forrest and his supporters have sort of organized at this point to get their revenge. So they're, you know, he's dogged on his whole tour with people. I mean, this is a boisterous crowd. They're booing, they're hissing. In Ohio, in one performance, the crowd throws half the carcass of a rotten sheep up on stage, like while he's performing.
God.
And it's really gross. Right?
You know, times were... You could hardly get away with throwing half a rotten sheep on the stage these days.
Well, we thought punk rock was a big deal, but this is extreme.
Were you here? When did you arrive in Seattle?
Later, 2004. Yeah. So I missed the good old days.
In the early 90s, there were, because the Seattle scene was not one thing.
Oh, right.
Right. It was a dozen.
There were some anarchist bands back then.
There were, but there were also like hair metal bands.
Yeah,
there were. You know, there were like... light pop bands.
Right.
And there, I went to some shows where the guys at the front of the stage were really antagonistic toward the band because the band was too frou-frou or too
professional.
Oh.
Too much like they wanted to get signed and go to the big time.
Too much Pearl Jam and not enough Nirvana.
That really that.
Yeah.
You know, where it actually got hostile in the room, but it was it was a Gen X hostility. So yeah. It was like, boo, you suck.
Yeah.
Sell out. But so loud that the band couldn't focus. And, you know, you watch singers get really flustered.
Yeah. Being a sellout back then was problematic.
Oh, my God. There was the worst thing you could be, a sellout.
And now that's all they want to do is sell.
Who even knows what it means, right?
Yeah.
If you could get a commercial endorsement of your Instagram.
Why wouldn't you do it? That's authenticity.
Wax. Yeah, for sure.
You need the money.
For sure. But so I've actually seen some much, there were no dead sheep involved, yeah, but there were
rotting.
There were no rotting
half sheep, carcass.
But there were class differences, yeah, between bands in this town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, God, 35 years ago, but for sure it would get to the point of, if not violence, certainly intimidation.
Well, and the audience was much more active with slam dancing and all that stuff way back when. I mean,
yeah, there was violence for sure.
It could be.
But not Gangs of New York level, like hitting people with a shillelagh.
No, people didn't sharpen their pinky nails so that they could gouge people's eyes out back then, as they did in Gangs of New York and throughout the frontier. That was a common thing, apparently.
The sharpened pinky.
You know, you could get somebody with your pinky.
Good Lord.
So it was violent. It was a violent time back then. And theater riots, by the way, were common.
Our long pinky nails were used for cocaine in the 1980s.
Much more like
little cocaine shovel. Right.
Terrible drug. So anyway, what happens is he's on tour, half a carcass of a rotted sheep, gets to New York, and May 7th, the dudes are organized to protest at the Astor Place Opera House, show up, they buy tickets, get inside, and just start throwing stuff, like coins and fruit. And by the end of the performance, they've ripped up their chairs and hurled these things on stage. And in both instances, with the sheep and also in that performance, MacReady finishes the performance, as one does.
And what is
consummate
the play?
Professional. He's performing as Hamlet. No, is it Macbeth? Sorry about that. It's Macbeth.
Macbeth.
Yeah, in New York. So, yes, Macbeth. Finishes the play, sneaks out the back door. He's like, I'm out of here. I'm going back to London. I've had enough. This is not fun.
Yeah.
And the aforementioned Herman Melville, Washington Irving, Horace Greeley, and others sign a petition saying, no, please, you must complete your run. Stay in New York. You know, that type of behavior is beneath us. And the mayor of New York, Caleb S. Woodhull, vows to protect him and says, look, we can guarantee your safety. The show must go on. It's meaningful to them.
Yeah.
Part of what's meaningful, right, is who is going to control public space in New York City? Who is going to control and define what theater is? An outside agitator circulates a handbill that calls on all working men to gather outside the Astor Place, aristocratic, I should say. They use that word, aristocratic Astor Place Opera House, to stop this performance. So the mayor's like, this is escalating. This is getting really serious.
Sure.
So he's like, I don't know that the cops can preserve the order here. So he calls on the equivalent of the National Guard, the 7th.
The militia.
Yeah, the 7th New York militia, to preserve the order. And of course, these guys are not really trained in crowd control techniques.
No, and one would assume that they were also working class, or like this is like a strike breaker situation.
Well, they're professionals.
Yeah, they're getting paid. That's right.
So, I mean, just like the police. So they show up. There are thousands, over 10,000, 10,000, 15,000 people show up, which is a lot.
You're
in
kidding.
New York in those days. A lot of people outside the theater. They start hurling paving stones at the windows. They start trying to break down the door. One person tries to set fire to it, right? They're pretty serious in their intent to stop this performance from occurring, because the aristocratic opera house is offending their way of life.
Yeah, right? They're trying to steal Macbeth from them.
Yeah. So at a certain point, and they're, you know, they're injuring, I think, dozens of police officers. There's a violent riot going on.
Yeah.
So the head of the militia is there for a reason. And he's like, well, what am I going to do? I don't know if he said that, but, you know,
yeah.
And orders his troops to fire directly into the crowd. 22 or more injured, 100 or killed, more than 150 injured. The streets are just full of blood
right.
outside this Astor House. Inside, once again, MacReady finishes the performance, sneaks out the back door, goes to London. It destroys him, never comes back to the United States, does a farewell tour and retires. One final performance of Macbeth at the Drury Theater in London, and then that's it. Just goes into retirement. It just breaks this guy.
Wow. And what does it do to American-English cultural relations?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a battle over culture, right? Yeah. But I think the way to think about that is, what does it do to society in England and in the United States in terms of Balkanization? Because if the goal of these middle class reformers is to uplift society, we're going to improve things, we're going to make it better, what ends up happening is the law of unintended consequences, right? Shakespeare gets walled off and sort of removed from popular culture. And working class dudes, Dobbs, they start going to vaudeville or strip clubs or true sort of lowbrow entertainment, as well as eventually movies and things like that. And Shakespeare and the rest of it ends up here kind of walled off in highbrow culture.
And did that start manifesting itself right away? I mean, when you think about the music of the Civil War and you think about the artistic world of Civil War United States, like, what did it look like?
It's a process, right? So I mentioned Lincoln's in the theater. Some people think that's why he's shot. But obviously, he's the president of the United States. So there is the emergence of respectable theater. Now women can attend the theater, which is a good thing. You know, previously, they would have been confused for sex workers. Now they can actually go. And so this sort of split and the bifurcation is starting in the 1840s in the U.S. and continues. But even if you look at the history, say, of burlesque theater, in the 1860s, there's a group of burlesque performers from England that come over, and they're called the British Blondes. And they're incredibly popular, but unlike the way people would have thought of burlesque in, say, the 1920s, back then they were just kind of these super witty comedians who dressed in fairly risque fashion, and they were popular with middle-class audiences, men and women alike. But similar to our other story, anti-vice crusaders kind of come along and say, this is not something we should really be doing.
Well, that's the can-can.
Yeah. It's not something we should be, respectable audiences should be appreciating.
Right.
And so it ends up, again, kind of being pushed more underground, and burlesque ends up becoming what we would have. It's hard to say because there's been a revival of that kind of burlesque
for
more
sure.
recently, but the burlesque, the sort of unseemly burlesque we think of in the 1920s, it became more like that. Striptease.
To your point, the show that Lincoln was watching,
yes,
was a play called
American Cousin or something.
Yeah, Our American Cousin.
Our American Cousin, right?
From 1858, and it was written by an Englishman. Famous for its slob versus snob plot.
That's right.
About a boorish American, and he inherits an English estate, which is a classic.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
it's the Beverly Hillbillies.
It's Beverly Hillbillies, or what was the, there was a play, like one of those Disney plays with David Niven, and it starred, what the hell, the young actress who was in Mean Streets.
Jodie Foster.
It starred Jodie Foster as a like a rebellious teenager.
Oh, I know this movie.
Candleshoe.
Yeah,
where she goes to England and it turns out, you know, she's the Duchess or whatever. That's you see that plot over and over.
Yeah, the American cousin is in England and speaking French. I've read this play. I mean, that's the kind of weird stuff that I've done. and he's speaking French with a terrible, you know.
And everybody laughs.
I'd like some hors d'oeuvres, please, or something like that. And yeah, everybody laughs. And the play was laughs.
Written only 10 years after these events, or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, right. And so that sense of Americans as kind of charming and vulgar might have been how someone like Edwin Forrest would have always been received in England. It was just by the 1840s, it's like the ugly version. So I'm not so sure an American cousin, if it's not just the charming, it's the charming American. An American audience would have laughed at
yeah,
it. Laughed at their own rough manners and thought it was kind of fun.
As we do now.
As we do now.
Yeah, we think of ourselves as, sure, not super refined. No. That's the American way.
The only other thread here, though, there's a couple. One is what happens to Edwin Forrest. Do you care?
I do. And I think the omnibus is going to need to know.
He doesn't end his career. He actually has a very lucrative career. Dies in the 1860s. But becomes sort of more popular in the West,
yeah,
or the South and the Midwest. And among the kinds of people who would have aspired to go to the Astor Place Opera House, his reputation falls a little bit after this incident.
But we do see,
even though he doesn't cause it, but right, he plays a role.
We do see this kind of theater portrayed, the bawdy theater of the West.
Yes.
It's not just the vaudeville, but this idea of some
variety shows,
yeah,
and the can-can dancers
and doing yeah, what sounds like an elevated,
yes,
but then they slip and fall on a banana.
Right.
Or, yeah.
That tradition of seeing actors as not people to be worshipped,
right,
but as potential confidence men.
Yeah,
scammers. Really comes out of that whole tradition of anti-theatricality. And you tie to that in American history the fact that you get the rise of sort of an invisible capitalist marketplace as opposed to you and I, John, trading apples and whatever, you know, around the village square. And now we've got to deal with all of these unknown people in society. Right. So you get a lot of that in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s, like a lot of anxiety about strangers and who could be more strange than a visiting actor.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's some underlying anxiety about that, but I think it's like always anxiety tinged with excitement.
Well, that concludes the Astor Place Riot, entry 76.PR2817, certificate number 26694 in the omnibus. Futurelings, you know how we feel about social media, and David and I spent a long time in the exciting get to know me part of our broadcast available on Patreon, talking about how social media has ruined everyone's life, and how David is not on Instagram, but you still do go around Twitter sometimes just as a reporter.
BlueCityPodcast.com and our other podcast, Real Seattle Nice.
Oh, Real
Seattle. If people are into the Seattle thing.
Yeah, are both available there. But otherwise, avoid social media except for the following places. You can watch this show on YouTube at youtube.com/@TheOmnibusProject. You can find Omnibus on Facebook and Instagram at Omnibus Project. Also, there are communities on Reddit, Discord, Facebook, and other places. Just put Futurelings into your browser and they'll all pop up. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can submit a proposal for a show to omnibusproject.com/submit. And you can send us physical mail. If you want to avoid the internet in every way, shape, and form, care of the Omnibus Project at 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And finally, please subscribe to our addenda show, to our get to know me show. There are a lot of other benefits available to people who join our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. It's a veritable cornucopia, as we like to say. How often do you say cornucopia without saying veritable? It feels like the two words really belong together.
Almost always.
A veritable cornucopia of additional content.
How often do I say either word?
Right. It hardly ever comes up, but when you are thinking of a cornucopia, it's a veritable one.
It must be.
So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. Join the gang. For only $5 a month, you get more content than you can shake a stick at, which is a 19th century tradition, shaking sticks at things.
Or baton.
Or large batons. So yes, support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.